Welcome to Uncovered, the podcast from the Centre for Visual Cultures at Royal Holloway, University of London. My name is Martina Borghi, visiting lecturer at the Department of Languages, Literatures and Cultures, and I will be hosting today's episode of the podcast. I'll be talking to Dr. Stacey Baldrick, which is Associate Professor at Leicester University, and we will discuss about the concept and the definition of iconoclasm and the relationship among museums, curatorship, and iconoclasm. Welcome, Stacey, to the Royal Holloway Centre for Visual Cultures podcast. And thanks for accepting my invitation to participate. Just to give a brief introduction to our listeners, Dr. Stacey Baldrick is Associate Professor and Program Director for the Master in Art Museum and Galleries Studies at University of Leicester. I first became interested in Stacey's research thanks to a paper she delivered at the Spring School of the University of Padua on risk management for cultural heritage last April. And I thought that her research was in line with the purpose of this podcast. So thanks again, Stacey. And can you please introduce yourself and tell us something about your work, about your research?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me, Martina. It's great to be here. So my research generally looks at iconoclasm in different periods and in different places. And my own background and sort of chronological periods of specialization include medieval art in the British Isles and iconoclasm, mm-hmm. and contemporary art around the world.
Oh, perfect. So we are both art historians.
We're both art historians. And I also, as an undergraduate, studied fine art and art history together. So have that understanding of a little bit of an understanding of making and those processes.
And materials too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So the key concept for today's podcast is the concept of iconoclasm. The relevance of the concept of iconoclasm has increased, in my opinion, in recent years due to several episodes of destruction or dismantling of public monuments in different areas of the West. So I believe this is a topic that can be of interest in many ways and that weaves together many areas of research, ranging from like historical research to contemporary curatorship. So let us start from the basics. So how can we define the concept of iconoclasm? Can we distinguish the term iconoclasm from that of vandalism, in your opinion?
So I think we can distinguish these terms. And really, the first person to do this really well was Dario Gamboni in his publication, The Destruction of Art. So early on, he spends some time discussing the meaning and origins of the term vandalism and the term iconoclasm. And while no term is necessarily perfect, there are some good reasons why he suggests that iconoclasm is more, quote unquote, scientific or preferable. And my colleague Richard Clay also discusses this in a later book, Iconoclasm, Contested Objects, Contested Terms. So the term vandalism very generally comes from the French Revolution, and the origins of the term lie in a reference to the Germanic tribe of the Vandals. And so with the use of this term, there's the implication that those Vandals, those others, are uncivilized and ignorant and the other. So the use of the term vandalism in that sense is negative, denigrating, condemnatory. The use of the term iconoclasm, which comes from the Greek icon and klastes, so image and to break, that was a term used by the Byzantines, and it comes out of an application to religious images. But scholars like Gamboni and Clay and others tend to prefer the term iconoclasm because it's more neutral. It's also more open in terms of whether it's a good or bad action that it's referring to, whether the iconoclast is a quote-unquote good or bad person. Yeah. I mean, the term vandalism really polarizes things, whereas ideally the term iconoclasm opens things up. But iconoclasm is also not a perfect term, as I kind of alluded to a minute ago. And all sorts of other terms have been suggested by iconoclasm scholars, including semioclasm and others. So for the moment, we're using this term, and a lot of us are using this term in what we call a kind of expanded sense, so that it's not just referring to religious iconoclasm, but rather referring to contested images and responses to it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I really appreciate the fact that you consider it a neutral term and a term that could include both good and bad inside this definition. And we will see during this conversation how, like, the idea of iconoclasm could include also creativity and active research. And so violently attacked work of arts are often defined as living identities, because I remember that you introduced this concept during the Spring School in Padua. I remember one slide about this idea, and this particularly struck me. So also reading the introduction of your book, Iconoclasm and the Museum, which was published in 2020 and which I'm reading now, you refer to the very famous attack, which is by the suffragette Mary Richardson, on the artwork, the Rokeby Venus, which is displayed at the National Gallery, has the attack on the representation of a body in order, like, to shed light and save a real human being, which was the suffragette Emmeline Pankhurst, who was imprisoned at the time. So given this long premise, so what do you think is, like, the connection between the manipulation of a work of art and the idea of a living, abused body?
So we could talk about that in lots of different ways, but I'll just start by thinking about the fact that works of art can sometimes become symbols, and that they are representations most of the time. But with that power of being a symbol, certain works of art can attract strong emotions and strong emotional interactions. That is kind of one thing. And that's one thing that David Friedberg writes about in his book, The Power of Art, which is another one of those key early texts on iconoclasm. But the other way of thinking about it too, historically, is to see that quite often, and again, I don't like to generalize and say this is the case everywhere in every place, but quite often you see that forms of punishment align with attacks on contested objects. So during the Reformation in England, the punishments that might take the form of cutting off an ear or another appendage aligned with some of the ways in which religious sculpture was defaced in the 16th century with the Reformation and different policies against religious images.
Okay. You mentioned David Friedberg before, and I was wondering if iconoclasm has something to do with neo-art history, and I think it could be very interesting to, like, deepen this topic more.
Because, definitely. So when I think of the new art history, I think of art history in the 1980s. And yes, that's definitely when feminist art history and Marxist art history and social history of art and all of these interests in different approaches to art history were coming to the fore. So I think we could think of it in that way. What's interesting is to see the interest in iconoclasm and research into iconoclasm really burgeoning post-2020, but also there have been waves of it that don't perfectly align with attacks on monuments. But it's interesting to see it grow over the decades.
So to conclude my questions for this first part of the podcast on a possible definition of iconoclasm, I would like to recall some of your words used during your presentation in Padua. So you described, I remember, acts of iconoclasm, and I quoted, as like often sensationalized, generalized, distorted, mythologized, and misunderstood. So how is like the media's relationship with this word and concept today? How is this idea of iconoclasm depicted by media, in your opinion?
So that's a really good question. So I think, again, a number of things happen. So quite often, let's just take monument toppling, for example, when something like this starts to happen, journalists might be first on the scene to document and report what's actually happening. However, in the speed to publish, quite often there are mistakes made, and it's a subjective experience when you're witnessing one of these things, and it's easy to get things wrong. Okay. It's easy to get things wrong in the heat of the moment. It's easy to get things wrong when you're back in your office redocumenting everything.
It's a very subjective way to react, to iconoclasm.
But iconoclasm is also emotional. You know, it's, again, if you're present and witnessing something that's happening that takes the form of monument toppling, because there are lots of different forms of iconoclasm that aren't necessarily as exciting, so to speak. But if you're witnessing that, and then your job is to report that in some way, not only can mistakes get made along the way due to emotional volatility, but also the fact that these stories, these dramatic stories, are useful to the media who want to increase their audiences.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. Late capitalism, hurrah. So it's also been interesting to see publications, more commercially minded or trade books, come out on the topic, some of which are, you know, written by scholars and tremendously well referenced and wonderful, and that is great, you know. But some of them completely rely on journalism and stories that should be scrutinized too. So
So we should include another area of research, fact-checking and iconoclasm.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It would definitely be useful, definitely.
Yeah, but it's interesting to look at the reports on the Roque B. Venus attack, because this is the same sorts of conclusions were made that were incorrect as they might be made now. So it's, it's a risk.
Okay, perfect. Okay, focusing now on our like discussion more on the link between museum, curatorship, and iconoclasm. What is like the link between museum space, exhibitions offering, and iconoclasm, in your opinion? So how is iconoclasm perceived or contextualized? So what is, in general, the institutional attitude toward the act of image breaking? I know this is a huge question, but can you please like try to give
us an
idea? Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a really great question. And there are lots of ways to answer that as well. But one of the basic things to say is that museums exist to look after their collections and protect them. So in general, it's understandable that they might not want to focus on acts of destruction when they're talking about every single fragment, and that's understandable. And yet, museums are often showing fragments to the public, and some of those fragments are objects of iconoclasm. You know, they're the results of iconoclastic actions. And I think for a long time, there hasn't tended to be much of a reference to how that fragment became a fragment, partly because of art history and the way art history approaches works of art and fragments, too. The plan has tended to be, let's try and figure out how this was made, who made it, when they made it, what the original context looked like, let's think about origins. Yeah. And what I think museums can do a little bit better is to focus on what some scholars call the social life of the object, which is really interesting, whereby there's a work of art that's made for a particular purpose at a particular time. And while all of that information is really key to understanding how that thing came into the world, what's also interesting is to think about how that object moved around. If it was subjected to iconoclasm, why did that fragment survive? Who saved it? Yeah. Who broke it? And why exactly? Mm-hmm. And quite often that information isn't recorded because it's not understood to be part of the making of the object. And yet it leads to the formation of the thing that we have in the present. So the other thing that museums are kind of a part of, which is maybe a little bit more complicated, has to do with our approaches to history and historical periods and art objects and historical periods, whereby the academy encourages art historians to focus on particular periods. And so they might be able to say everything about the original context of a religious altarpiece, but if then that altarpiece is broken into pieces, buried and rediscovered in the 19th century and then redisplayed, there isn't necessarily a scholar with expertise in all fields who can then sort of track various moments of that art object's quote unquote social life.
Yeah.
So the academy encourages us to be specialists. Mm-hmm. And in that way, we fragment time, I guess, and we fragment the object in terms of the way we approach it and research it. And James Simpson talks about this as another form of iconoclasm.
Iconoclasm, yeah. Yeah, it's a sort of metaverse of iconoclasm,
exactly.
Inside iconoclasm. Yeah,
exactly.
Definitely. But this determines the fact that iconoclasm is an interdisciplinary area of research, definitely. Mm-hmm. So, like, try to deepen this idea and this, relationship between museums and iconoclasm. How, in your opinion, does the narrative communication and display attitude change in museums towards objects?
It's helpful here to mention Bruno Latour's work. Bruno Latour and Peter Weibel and a whole panoply of art historians and academics curated an exhibition a couple of decades ago now called Iconoclash. And they also looked at how attitudes to objects of iconoclasm change. And Bruno Latour, in his introductory essay, talks about the fact that it's one institutional approach to presenting iconoclasm, let's say it's Reformation iconoclasm, is to kind of fictionalize it and dramatize it in its original context and to talk about it as this thing that's safely in the past and something else altogether from the current historical moment in which we're viewing an exhibition. You also come across this in the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, which is a relatively new museum, and I talk about it in the book, where the monument to George III is toppled, and it's at the center of this permanent collection display. They've made a film of it. They've reconstructed it. So these things are out there, and yet more recent displays to monument toppling, around which there were a whole series of very polarized emotional debates. I'll mention the statue of Colston in Bristol.
Exactly.
As a key moment. There were so many events, you know, post-pandemic, so many events taking place online, which debated the presence of Colston on a monument versus its deposition or it's being taken down and thrown into the sea. There were so many of these events, and I tried to go to as many as I could, where different community groups, groups of academics, other groups were debating what should happen to monuments such as Colston. Mm-hmm. And the idea to put it in a museum and to put all contested monuments into museums was quite a common suggestion and conclusion. Yeah. Meanwhile, my friends in museums showed concern about this because there's no room in museums for all contested monuments in the world. There's no time for all the curators to work towards displays and interpretation for them, etc. So, and yet going back to Colston, what's very interesting is that Colston's monument has been redisplayed, not standing up, but rather on its side as a toppled monument bearing the graffiti that it acquired in 2020. And so that's a rare example at the moment of a toppled monument and a display that shows its contemporary history and doesn't try to erase that or pretend that the monument is back in its original context. So, and it's very well interpreted. They worked with different community groups on the display and the interpretation. And it's a really, it's a really, it was a phenomenal approach to presenting that to the public.
So if I remember correctly, I started reading your chapter about your experience in Philadelphia. If I remember correctly, you wrote that there like was to be afraid also watching at an empty plinth. That police was like staring at you and a little bit intimidating. And I was like wondering about the power of emptiness, the power of an empty plinth, how much this could be powerful, just like a tortured statue in the same way. Emptiness could have the same power, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, you're referring to the beginning of chapter three. And that's that was when I was in Memphis, Tennessee. And I was there at a time when after they had deposed two Confederate statues. But the plinth still remained for one of them. And yes, there were CCTV cameras everywhere and police cars.
Very intimidating.
Yes, exactly. And at the time, there was an act called the Tennessee Heritage Protection Act, which was brought into being to dictate how monuments could be treated and objects of heritage should be treated by the public. And it was an act that was amended several times. To the point where it was illegal to physically interact with the monument itself. Yeah. So, yes, quite interesting.
So taking advantage from what you said about Bristol, so as I discovered when I started reading your book, a museum face numerous challenges in proposing effective communication strategies when dealing with objects intact or not, that have undergone, correct me if I'm wrong, ontological transformation due to iconoclast acts. So in your opinion, should the museum consider this object as transformed from the original essence, or has real work of art different from what they were before?
It's a great question. And I think I would go back to this concept of the social life of the object, really. And it's probably because I'm an art historian. I think of long histories and as everything being a part of that. So I'd probably go with option one.
Okay.
It's transformed from their original essence. That's how you put it, I think. Transformed, but still retaining that point of origin, if that makes sense.
Yes. Okay. I thought you were choosing option two. I don't know why, but...
So that's my perspective. But I think individuals will see these things in the way they want to. And plenty of individuals will see the work very much only in the present.
Probably option two. So the idea to consider it something completely new could be helpful for people who do not accept the meaning behind the statue, and I think it could be helpful for them to accept the fact that this item is still displayed, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So coming back to curatorship, so like based on your experience, your research and your case studies that you investigate, so what is the mistake that from a curatorial strategy point of view, museums tend to make today?
Okay. So I can think of a couple, one of which is forgetting. Forgetting or not being aware of the full history of the object, forgetting either willfully or unwittingly, forgetting whereby you think that you must only talk about that object in a particular way in one moment in time. The other mistake that I think is often made, which is really completely understandable, museums aim to reconstruct the original object. If they have a fragment, they show reconstruction of it, or they show an image of it before destruction. And talk about the original thing rather than the fragment that they have. And reconstruction is almost a kind of automatic response to fragments. We want the whole, you know, we could talk about gestalt stuff, but I think we also want to repair something that's broken.
Maybe something that it's innate in us, to we have to see things like they were before in their intact shape. That's why neuroartistry could help us to better understand some some reaction to iconoclasm. But my question is, if reconstruction is a form of iconoclasm too, in your opinion?
Yes, that's a nice, that's very good.
Yeah, because in the same way we hide something else. So trying to reshape in the original, you know, nature, the artifact, we definitely hide something else.
Absolutely. And I think we're also seeing it in so I've seen that there are curatorial posts that have been developed which refer to hidden histories. And so going back to the issue of forgetting, there's so many things in museum collections that have been there forever and you know, are in storage for long periods of time. And it takes new projects and new generations to uncover those collections. I'm thinking of Sonia Boyce's project, Black Artists and Modernism, going into different museums and looking at works by Black artists who work that was collected at a certain period of time, but have not been on public display for a long time, and how her project and the work of others too have led to a recalibration and looking again at those collections and showing them.
So I had prepared another question, but I think you have already answered to it a bit, because the question was, what are the strategies that a curator should follow to best incorporate different perspectives and combine historical narratives and reflections related to a contemporary context when planning the exhibition and didactic offer of certain problematic objects? So can you make some examples?
So I suppose one of the risks that might result from deciding to address a problematic object is if you're presenting that material object with all the voices and all the interpretations of it, that in itself can be overwhelming. So to think hard about an interpretation strategy that doesn't compete with the material object, but rather supports it. And it's perfectly possible to provide a number of perspectives on an object, whether that's, again, depending on what type of fragment or what type of object you're showing or artwork. One could use quotations from different people, from the artist, from the iconoclast to the curator. It's also possible to include film, focusing on its destruction or its presentation in another historic setting. Yeah, I think I would want to resist overwhelming the viewer with interpretation, but rather giving them a few key ways in.
Try to balance every kind of narrative related to the object, which I can understand it's not easy for curators to achieve.
Exactly. So, editing is difficult.
Yeah,
and prioritizing.
Exactly. Prioritize without offending anyone, you know?
Exactly.
And putting everything on the same level, it's in a democratic way. It's not easy.
Yeah, exactly.
I can feel it very much, because in Italy we have the problem of the representation of the fascism. And definitely is extremely problematic. It's impossible, to design a museum or a collection or, something about fascism without offending someone. It's very difficult to propose something in a neutral way. And so I can really understand the problem and the challenges that curators could face. So I would like to conclude this part of our conversation with a huge question, but feel free to answer only to one of the three part of this question. So can digitization, data analysis, and the use of archives help to shed light on iconoclast narratives within the museum environment?
So I think all three of these things can help with the digitization of contested objects in collections. That's a helpful starting point for ideally bringing together archival materials as well as data analysis and encouraging research on those objects. But I think curators are definitely under pressure to do the work that they need to do, which quite often doesn't prioritize research or going back to all archives and looking at them again to see what's physically there. And ideally, historians of iconoclasm could help in this respect. I've been privileged to examine a few PhDs just in the last 6 months that are all undertaking massive projects to do with bringing together archival evidence with everything else to track the social lives of objects, to analyze the strategies that certain groups have when it comes to committing iconoclastic acts. Yes, it's a kind of forensic work that needs to be done objects of iconoclasm. Yes, a careful look at archival evidence, which may not be found just in the object file. It might be found in other archives or other places completely. So it's really challenging.
It's like building a net.
Exactly.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. Digitalization of collections could definitely help.
And there are some good projects out there too, digital projects to do with specific churches and pinpointing exactly where in the church a fragment has come from. So there are good projects out there outside of the museum.
I would like now to focus on another interpretation of the term iconoclasm. One aspect that I found particularly interesting in your presentation in Padua, and which is meticulously addressed in your book, is the analysis of numerous contemporary artists who use iconoclasm in their creative work. In this way, iconoclasm, in my personal opinion, of course, become like a sort of research tool, a harbinger of new contributions and content, as I define it. So it's interesting to note how this concept can be associated with terms like production, creativity, and investigation of reality instead of just destruction, tampering, or violence. So what criteria have you used to select the artists you are interested in and that you studied? So have you identified categories around which you can group their work or not?
Yeah, I think so. And thanks for that question. It's nice to think about these things in this way. I think it's interesting. A lot of artists are rediscovering collections, as I alluded to before. They're rediscovering artworks and interesting things that one might not initially think of as artworks. They're rediscovering these images in archives. So Kate Davis discovering in the quote-unquote women's history archive.
The pamphlet you are mentioning,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, the pamphlet. So there's a she found a pamphlet with an image of the suffragette Christabel Pankhurst, and her face had been deliberately damaged, suggested a conservator. Mm-hmm. To Kate. So Kate Davis turned this image into an artwork of her own, and she's very interesting in that drawing is a key part of her practice, and so she drew the image, enlarged the image so that it was life size, and there's an allusion to the viewing body as well as Christabel Pankhurst's body being represented and brought back to life, so to speak. Yeah. So the image that she produced was complex. It was a drawing of Christabel Pankhurst's face and the damaged sort of gouged bit drawn as well. And that was, there was also a printed element to it. So she was replicating the printing of the pamphlet. So I would say that rediscovering collections and artworks and archives is one approach. And then other artists like Hugh Locke make new narratives. So Hugh Locke, long before the Colston Monument was toppled, produced a series of photographic works of monuments, which he added to them as a way of kind of correcting them or recalibrating them. And I think he's talked about this as being mindful of vandalism. So what he was trying to do in that series, again, just to be very general about it, is trying to make a kind of atonement happen for problematic individuals such as Colston and others. And an example of a whole body of work that he made that resonates so powerfully. And then with Titus Kaphar, Kaphar's work it's really varied in materials and the kind of larger thinking behind it.
It reminds me of Kahinde Wiley for some aspects of his work. Mm-hmm. With Kahinde Wiley work on Baroque and Renaissance period style painting, replacing white people with black people from his environment. And I think that more or less the idea is similar. But, you know, the concept of iconoclasm emerged clearly in Titus' work.
Yeah, there's an attempt to recalibrate and subvert and critique everything there. Yes, exactly. And Titus Kaphar's, the works that he produced at Princeton related to the whole Princeton and Slavery Project, which was a huge collective research project. So it's great when artists are able to work with a big academic research project and to make artworks that then communicate really powerfully to audiences the huge amount of work that's gone into a project like that. Yeah.
Great. So we are finally introducing the final part on this discussion about iconoclasm. So I have a few other general questions to ask you. Iconoclasm is certainly, we can consider it a worldwide phenomenon, which whole societies and cultures have in common. I remember you said that in Padua. Basically, studies focus more on the Western culture, if I am correct. So, but what can be said about the Eastern part of the world?
So certainly iconoclasm studies as a field of study, it's very Western in its approach and its origins, and there needs to be a lot more work that's included by scholars of the quote-unquote global south. This is an issue, but interestingly, one of the PhDs I've examined looks at the looting of a fragment of a mural painting in a remote part of China, and its movement via Paris to the V&A, and this amazing PhD project.
I'm jealous of your PhD student. Now I want to do another PhD.
Yeah, exactly. But what she did was look at and critique all the elements of the stages of the process and the breaking away and taking, stealing of this, and yet the provenance of the object, it was purchased along the way, and it ends up where it is. But in the meantime, there's a heritage site that's missing a bit of its mural and a bit of a mural that's in a museum. So there's a lot of work to do, but also a lot of work to do which brings scholars and curators together.
Yes. I didn't consider this question, but I want to ask you if, in your opinion, there could be a link between iconoclasm and trafficking.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Because part of what's happened in Palmyra is that with the destruction of everything there, there's been illicit trade going on at various levels in different parts of the world. And this is something that was really fascinating to hear about at the Spring School, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So even scholars who authenticate fragments coming into question ethically.
I'm definitely interested in trafficking because in the past I cataloged a collection which was confiscated from mafia, from Italian mafia. So this is definitely a topic which I'm interested in. So focusing on your research, I would like to ask you, what would you like to focus on in your research in the future?
Oh, thanks for asking. So at the moment, I'm working on a project to do with looking at collections of fragments of religious sculpture that remain on the same site of the church building in which they were originally in situ. So I'm looking at the survival of these collections of fragments, and I'm looking at sites in the British Isles, and I'm just about to expand this project. I've done a little pilot project, but asking questions about how it has come to be that those fragments survived and the ways in which they are displayed or not. And so that's one project. But what I also hope to do is to relate to it some case studies of incidents where fragments have survived in some way, and to look at the reasons for their survival as a result of some kind of iconoclastic event.
And I remember that you mentioned, for example, Friedberg and Gamboni during our chat, but I would like to ask you any reading suggestions to those who would like to deepen their knowledge on this topic. If you like, what books do you recommend, for example?
So, yes, if I had a list of books, I'd be able to.
I remember three slides during your speech in Padua, full of, you know, bibliographic references.
Yeah, I can name some names. So for anyone who's interested in medieval iconoclasm, Margaret Aston's great book, Broken Idols of the English Reformation, is a great start. It's massive, but she really looks at all sorts of questions to do with specific policies against images during the 16th and later centuries, and also looks at how fragments have been discovered in churches since. So I've mentioned Bruno Latour's Iconoclash as a really important catalog from a little while ago. Also Robert Bevan's The Destruction of Memory, and more recently his book to do with monuments looks at Colston in great detail. If you're interested in archaeology and iconoclasm, a great start is Henry Chapman's book, Iconoclasm and Later Prehistory. James Simpson's name I've mentioned also, but one key work of his, which is really useful, is Under the Hammer, Iconoclasm in the Anglo-American Tradition. I can also recommend James Noyes's book, The Politics of Iconoclasm, where he looks at religion, violence, and the culture of image breaking in Christianity and Islam.
Yeah.
And also Ramon Sarro's The Politics of Religious Change on the Upper Guinea Coast, that book from 2009, and also Francisco Rambelli and Eric Rinder's Buddhism and Iconoclasm in East Asia is excellent too. And finally, a really specific article that that I like is Charlotte Joy's article, which looks at UNESCO World Heritage and Militant Islam in Mali.
Oh,
and that's in a book called World Heritage on the Ground: Ethnographic Perspectives, published in 2016.
Okay,
and. Finally, maybe one more reference to Jose Antonio Gonzalez Zarandana's work. He's been doing all sorts of amazing research on different aspects of iconoclasm, but he wrote an article with Ronan Lee called Heritage Destruction in Myanmar's Rakhine State, Legal and Illegal Iconoclasm, and that's in the International Journal of Heritage Studies. So that's hopefully that's a good international mix of of some
definitely
good places to start.
Yeah, definitely. I would like to conclude our chat with two speedy questions that we ask to all our guests. So the first one is, what is your favorite piece of visual culture that you have worked on directly?
So I'm never able to answer these questions easily. And it depends on my mood at any given point. But because you want me to choose one, I might say Rux Media Collective's piece Coronation Park, which presents a group of defaced monuments, colonial monuments.
The next question is, what is your favorite piece of visual culture in the world?
So again, that's really difficult.
Yeah, it's impossible.
I might choose Goya's Disasters of War.
Oh, okay.
Prince, yeah. But I'm also looking forward to seeing, hopefully, Steve McQueen's new work, which is called Base, and it's abstract, and it's just opened at Dia Beacon.
Okay, perfect. You were able to answer this very difficult question, probably the most difficult of the entire chat. Yeah.
Definitely, for me.
So, yeah. So I want to thank you again for your great conversation. And you definitely gave us an idea about what iconoclasm is. And thanks for introducing me to this fascinating world. As an art historian, and most of all as an Italian, I really feel that this is something that it's urgent to deepen, especially for some, as I said before, some aspect of my culture, for example, as past episodes of my past, for example, fascism. So I really think the studies of iconoclasm could help us to develop a new perspective to investigate this said period of our past and how to deal with artifacts which are difficult to exhibit nowadays, especially in my country. But I really want to thank you for this great conversation.
Thank you, Martina. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Uncovered. You can find references to the works discussed in the show notes. If you have any thoughts or questions about what we discussed, you can email us at centerforvisualcultures@rhul.ac.uk. You can also follow us on X or Instagram, both at rhul_CVC. The episode was hosted by me, Martina Borghi. It was edited by Gareth Youth. The music is by Gaspar Sena, and it was produced by the Center for Visual Cultures. See you next time!